The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Sarah Crown.
Pigeon English attracted some attention. I think there were 12 publishers involved in the bidding at one point. For me, being someone who's dreamed of being a writer since a very early age, to have that kind of attention was obviously very flattering, very exciting, all a bit of a whirlwind.
If they ask me, I could write a book.
I could choose and write about the houseboats of Srinagar, or the flowers, or the shikaras, or the tourism. But that wouldn't be the story I wanted to tell.
If they ask me, I could write a book about the way you walk and whisper and look.
The publication of your first book has the potential to be a life-changing experience, and this week the Books Podcast is devoted to the men and women in the running for the 2011 Guardian First Book Award, given to the best new author in any genre. Our first author, who was shortlisted for the only non-fiction book to make the cut this year, is oncologist Siddhartha Mukherjee. His extraordinary biography of cancer, The Emperor of All Maladies, has been praised by reviewers on both sides of the Atlantic as a compelling and beautifully written history of the 20th century's most feared disease, and has already won him a Pulitzer in his native US. I spoke to him on the line from New York and asked him why a research medic with a budding reputation and a full-time job at Columbia University decided to write a book.
Well, I mean, I was much like anyone in training in cancer medicine, I was in the trenches. But when I went home every night, the question was, could I pull back from the minutiae, from the details, and look at the larger trajectory of where we were in the war on cancer, what happens next, how do we get here? And in fact, patients kept asking me this question. They would say, well, what's the bigger picture here? And it was amazing to me that we didn't have a book that would allow us to talk about the bigger picture. So in the end, it was really a kind of a response when one particular woman asked me in the most poignant way, what was the history? What was her history? And so that was the genesis of the book. And the book really began as a much smaller exercise. I was keeping a journal. And the journal got bigger and bigger and bigger, and ultimately I started putting down what would become the kernel of the book. In terms of time, I mean, you know, I think when you have a project like this, you make the time. I have a very idiosyncratic method of writing, which is I write in short bursts here and there, everywhere. I keep the thoughts in my head, and then when I have a moment, I'll start putting them down. So in some ways, the book was a continuous conversation that went on in my head through the entire time the book was written, and I would find patches to then put that conversation down on papers.
You've called the book a biography of cancer. Why was that?
Well, the phrase biography of cancer came about quite late in the book. It was really conceived as a standard history. But then several things happened which changed that subtitle. One of them was that, as you know, I entered the book. Usually historians don't enter their histories. The second thing is that as I looked back at what I'd written, it felt I was drawing a portrait over time of the same illness. You know, cancer seen in 1850 and then 1950 and then hopefully in the future in 2050. And this idea of looking at the same illness, not one illness, of course, it's a family of diseases over time, over and over again, gave rise to the notion that maybe it is like a biography. And oddly enough, I mean, I had meant it as a kind of a poetic, a little bit of poetic license, but the term has caught imagination. Some people hate that idea. Others have loved it.
But there is, I mean, the anthropomorphization really seemed to me to be very effective, and partly because cancer comes out of the book as the perfect villain, this thing that's the inverse of ourselves, the evil alter ego. It felt almost, in a way, too neat, the way the metaphor was so perfect for the disease.
One has to be careful about over-personifying any illness. Of course, they occupy human beings, and patients describe themselves as being transformed into a different state. But that said, you know, you have to be careful, and I hope I was.
The battle that we have with cancer, it's characterised over and over again, and you talk about this in the book, as a war. But you say at the end of the book, the war on cancer may best be won by redefining victory. And I wondered, what did you mean by that?
One question that could be raised about the book is, can we eliminate cancer from ourselves, from our bodies, from our societies forever? Mm. And the answer, the quick answer, is no. The long, more qualified answer is, yes, we can delay, we can prevent, we can change the trajectories of many cancers, we can change carcinogens that are in our environment, but the notion that we will completely eliminate cancer from human societies and bodies, much like we might be able to eliminate polio, for instance, I don't think this will ever happen. And the reason, it does not have to do with human failing, but it oddly enough has to do with human success and a kind of cellular success. In other words, the very genes that allow our bodies to grow, our embryos to grow, the very genes that make us incredibly successful as organisms, if you distort those genes, you get cancer. So in other words, you can't dispense of this piece of biology from the human body. You can't say goodbye to these growth-controlling genes because they're fundamental to ourselves. Cancer is a distortion of self.
What have other people in the cancer community made of the book? Because it's fairly unusual, isn't it, in medicine to lift the lid in the way that you've done here.
I mean, in some ways, there was a sense of relief, I think, within the cancer community, because it felt as if the community was, you know, polarized between people who said, well, you haven't achieved anything, and other moments in which people would say, well, you know, haven't we achieved everything? I mean, aren't we making amazing new miracle medicines? And the history, as you know, is very complicated. It's very warty. It has warts. It has failings. It has egos. It has arrogance. It has hubris, but also unbelievable dedication and commitment, both on the side of patients and doctors. So oncologists and patients and cancer scientists come up to me and say, well, thank you for explaining what we've been doing and why it's been successful and why it's not been successful.
But one of the things that I did really love about the book, though, was the glimpses of humanity, the fact that this was not just technical, it wasn't just medical, it was about the people who were involved. And one of the people who shone out of it most strongly for me was a doctor who you talk about in the section Prevention is the Cure, Thomas Lynch, who was a lung cancer doctor I think you met during your fellowship.
He now happens to be the head of the Yale University Cancer Center.
Oh, so a good person to name check then.
Yeah.
But you said in the book that he had a particular talent for reconciling his patients' imagination with the reality of their diseases. And it made me wonder whether you viewed your book in the same light, sort of as a means of reconciling our collective imagination with the idea of cancer.
There is a process of reconciliation, isn't there, that goes on. I mean, you try to understand where we've arrived and how far we have to go. I mean, one of the things on rereading the book, I mean, as you know, it requires a commitment from the reader. I mean, you start off, you know, in 2500 BC with a kind of very dim knowledge of cancer cells. And you end up in the book, and you don't even realize it. I mean, I didn't when I was writing it. You don't realize it, but you end up with contemporary cancer genomics, talking about exactly what my laboratory talks about in its laboratory meetings every other Monday. That's a huge journey, and I think that process ultimately reconciles imagination with where we are.
When the shortlist for this year's First Book Award was announced, what stood out above all was the topicality of each of the books in the final five. From cancer to 9/11 to gang violence in Peckham to drug wars in Mexico. Mirza Wahid's book is no exception. Wahid works for the BBC World Service. He was brought up in Kashmir and his novel, The Collaborator, is a thriller about the tangled civil war going on there. He told Claire Armitstead about it on one of our summer programmes.
Who is the collaborator?
It is the narrator of the novel, but he's not really a collaborator. He's forced into a situation where he has to work with a very big security apparatus in his area. And he's forced into a very horrific job. His friends have left for Pakistan to become militants and to come back and fight the Indian Army. He's the one left behind, and eventually he finds himself in the employment of a rather ruthless army officer. And he goes down to a valley to look at corpses left behind in the war.
He has to pick identity
cards and weapons if they're there and other things. So he is a collaborator, but he's really an observer, and he has to be close to this massive military machine to tell us what he sees and thinks about what has happened in that region.
And it's set in a region that's pretty much a no-go zone now, is it?
Yes, for most of the time. Civilians can't go to the LOC. LOC is this border that divides the two parts of Kashmir, Indian and Pakistani administered Kashmir. When I was growing up, you couldn't go to the LOC, you know, because you can't. And I always wanted to imagine what it must be like in that strange place. It's a bizarre border, you know, because in 1947 you had villages cut into half, rivers sort of, you know, just next to each other, and you would have houses you could see from each, you know, from the windows. So that's now a theater of war, massive, brutal theater of war in the early 90s.
You said something like a million soldiers in it, is that right?
I wouldn't say a million, but if you add Indian and Pakistani soldiers, you're approaching a million, which makes it the most militarized region in the world.
Was there in the writing of this novel some sort of political intention, an intention to shed light on something that couldn't be otherwise illuminated?
Yes, I mean, it is the novel is political. You can trace the commencement of your imaginative life to what you've seen and lived. Now, obviously, you can choose what to do with it. I could choose and write about the houseboats of Srinagar or the flowers or the shikaras or the tourism. But that wouldn't be the story I wanted to tell.
Mirza Wahid there, telling a different side of Kashmir's story. Stephen Kalman also drew on the environment he grew up in when he came to write Pidgin English, the tale of an 11-year-old Ghanaian boy who turns detective on his council estate in the wake of a murder. The novel draws considerably on the real-life case of Damilola Taylor, the schoolboy who was murdered on a Peckham estate in November 2000. Stephen is with me in the studio now. Stephen, what was it like to write about something so current?
Aspiring to be a writer, I'd always wanted to write something that had some relevance to modern society and was about something, I guess. And we're always taught to write what we know. And I was lucky that the environment in which I was living was so full of material from which I could draw.
Where you were living, you grew up in?
I grew up on a council estate called Marsh Farm in Luton. And it was a very diverse neighbourhood, but also with its fair share of problems. There was some deprivation there, some crime. Obviously, those are topics that feature in the book. And also, it was a place in which I imagined my character quite easily could have ended up. Where I lived was 5 minutes walk away from my local high school, for instance, and I would walk past groups of kids on their way to school as I was on my way to buy milk. And there were so many potential Harrys among those kids, and I was able to eavesdrop on their conversations. And from there, it was a natural decision to find Harry as a character among those kids.
You draw quite heavily on the story of Damilola Taylor, which we know so well from all the news reports. Did you feel a responsibility to Taylor and to his family when you were writing the book?
I wanted to pay tribute in some way to Damilola and also to those other victims that have fallen in the same way since him. And I think I just wanted to capture the spirit of Damilola somehow. I remember from the media coverage of his case how he was portrayed as such a bright and a smart and a sensitive and good kid. And it was that sense of loss, that loss of potential, which first compelled me to write. And I wanted to be true to that spirit.
This is a segment of society that really isn't written about a lot, even now, even, you know, when we have people writing from all over society. Why do you think that is?
There's a tendency, possibly amongst the middle classes and the media classes, to ignore this kind of environment. We know what we know of these places from the news and from coverage of bad news, unfortunately. And there's a sense that we don't really want to dig too much more deeply than that. And I wanted to show these kids not as the victims or as the criminal element that they are portrayed. I just wanted to show them as they are. They're, for the most part, kids who find themselves in difficult circumstances with limited opportunities. But at the end of the day, they're just trying to get on with the business of being kids and making the most of what they have.
And you had lots of people praise the novel for the way in which you managed to give a voice to an 11-year-old, an 11-year-old Ghanaian, neither of which, as I sit looking at you right now, are things that you could really lay claim to.
No,
was that difficult to inhabit that voice?
Surprisingly not, no. I found his voice came to me quite naturally. Obviously, I'd done some research before I started to try and get a flavour of where he would have come from.
What sort of research would that have been?
There was a growing Ghanaian presence in my community as I was beginning to plan the book. So listening to the way they spoke and interacted, and also drawing on my own past. I remember when I was 11 years old, my best friend was Dominican, and I remember some of the interactions I had with him and his family. And the rest, of course, is just a leap of imagination.
The books on the First Book Award shortlist this year all seem to have this uniting theme of topicality, of newsworthiness in a way.
Mm.
Why do you think that is? Do you think we've just got to the stage where, you know, the truth really is stranger than fiction and it's easier to write from the real world than it is to make things up?
I think so. I think the world is shrinking. The world is becoming a smaller place and we have access to so much material, so much news, and by extension, so many stories. And there's a wealth of stories out there for a writer to draw upon. You know, you're never going to be stuck for a compelling character or a compelling subject to write about. And that's, I think, the great joy of being a writer right now. And you would be foolish to ignore that. I think there's a tendency maybe in the past to find escapism in the past. But I think there's an appetite right now for stories about now that are present and relevant to us. And it's interesting and compelling as a writer to explore those real life stories.
And so is that what you'll continue to do? Is that what you're planning to do with your second book?
Yes, I think so. My second book is again about somebody who is alive now, today. I hope so, at least. I haven't heard from him for a few weeks, but he's a friend of mine who lives in Mumbai, who is a journalist by day and by night, shall we say, likes breaking interesting world records. He likes hitting himself with various objects such as concrete slabs and baseball bats.
Wow.
So yeah, it's partly a biography of him with some fictionalized elements attached to it. And okay. I think the one thing he does share with Harry as a protagonist is that he's, I think, a force for good in a difficult, dark environment. And those are the kind of characters I'm drawn to.
Okay, well, really good luck with the second book and good luck with the First Book Award. Thanks very much for coming in to talk to us.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
And another novel on the First Book shortlist is also born of the conflicts brought about by widespread crime. In Down the Rabbit Hole, which was voted onto the First Book Award shortlist by The Guardian's books website readers, Juan Pablo Villalobos tells the tale of Tochli, the child of a Mexican drugs lord. We met him at the Edinburgh Literary Festival in August, and he agreed to come to a bookshop to meet some readers with the help of his translator, Rosalind Harvey.
The thing I found most moving about this book was Tochli. I found his innocence heartbreaking, but I also found his humour quite amusing. My question throughout this was, how did you come up with him? Where did you find him?
Encontrar la voz de Tochli tuvo algo de magia.
He said there was something magical about how he found the voice of Tochli. And he was working on it for quite a long time when he suddenly just came up with the first sentence of the book, which in English is, some people say, I'm precocious. He felt that contained within that sentence was the tone for the whole book, so all of Tochli's personality was in that phrase, and it just felt right.
As a book artist, I really enjoyed all your references to books, and I wondered if you see them as a redeeming force.
Sí, lo importante en la novela es que hay un enfrentamiento entre la cultura libresca.
So in the book, there's a clash between the culture of books and the culture of experience. He felt it was interesting to highlight something in Mexico, which is a sort of rejection of the culture of books. So Tochli has a sort of struggle between these two cultures. He's obviously a man of books, a man of letters, and he thought it was interesting to show this sort of damaging hatred, as it were, towards the culture of books.
As it was written from a child's perspective, it seemed almost as important to miss things out of what was said and what was mentioned in the book. But one of the most important things missing seemed to be a mother figure. Was this deliberate so you could concentrate on just the male figures in his life, or is there a backstory that perhaps you were going to develop?
Es una pregunta muy interesante. Es deliberado el que no.
So it was deliberate. And it's an interesting question. And the fact also that all the other female characters are just sort of utilitarian, so there's a prostitute, there's a cleaner, a cook. It's a kind of provocative decision to call into question the role of the woman in Mexican society, where she's just sort of played a role as a housewife and just serving other people's needs.
En función de resolver los problemas de la familia.
I was just wondering how accurate some of the setting was in terms of, you know, the drug lord living in this sort of almost like a kind of compound away from everybody else. How did you do your research and how close is some of it to reality in Mexico?
No hice una investigación en términos periodísticos.
He didn't do a kind of journalistic set of research to do with the world of drugs exactly. Unfortunately, there's really no way that you can fail when you write in this way, because it's in Mexicans' collective consciousness. People feel that they know how these people live.
How the story ends with Toshli getting what he wants, albeit in quite a, I suppose, a sordid way, I really worry for his future now, and I'm wondering if you know how things are going to be for him.
Es una pregunta que me repiten mucho.
He's not determinist about it, and he doesn't think it's necessarily the case that Toshli will end up being like his father. You could say that in one sense nothing actually happens in the novel. So the bad guys just get what they want. He gets what he wants, but he gets a sort of stuffed, dried version of what he wants.
La realidad le llega muerta.
And our last author, Amy Waldman, like Mirza Wahid, another journalist, has told a story that was born out of the most catastrophic event ever to occur in her home city of New York, the destruction of the World Trade Center on September the 11th, 2001. The novel opens 2 years afterwards, when a council has been convened to judge an anonymous competition to design a memorial for the site of the atrocity. The council agrees on a design for a memorial garden, but everything falls apart when it turns out that the designer is a Muslim. The novel prefigured a real-world battle that commenced after Waldman had finished writing over plans to build a mosque near the Ground Zero site. Hadley Freeman asked her whether she felt she'd been overtaken by events.
I did do some rewriting in response, but it also was very fertile for my imagination, in the sense that it's rare to have sort of a template of your novel playing out in front of you, and so just to get... it wasn't so much exactly what happened, but more just the mechanics of how something like that works was very helpful.
Yeah, I mean, one of the amazing things about the novel is how you get so many different voices. And did that feel incredibly free as a former journalist to be able to look at everyone's opinions rather than just doing the dry reporting on the facts?
You know, in some ways it came out of my experience as a journalist, in that as a journalist, as you know, you often, you have access to a lot more perspectives than I think we do in our daily lives, because we tend to live surrounded by people who think fairly similarly. But as a journalist, you don't have that privilege in a way of shutting yourself off. You are constantly exposed to people challenging you. But also, I feel like, in a way, the novel is so much about how we misread each other.
And one of the characters who a lot of people have remarked on is Alyssa, and how she's the one character who really kind of is irredeemably awful, really. Mm-hmm. She's so horrible, and yet she's the journalist, the female journalist in the book, and the irony of that coming from you.
Right. It's funny, I never saw her as irredeemably awful, in the sense that I think she's unscrupulous, manipulative, I mean, her striving, but I've seen that in a journalist, to be honest, where you rationalize a lot about why you need to get someone to tell you something, or how you're getting them to tell it to you, and you sort of lose sight of what you're actually doing and why. But to me, there's something very human in that she's kind of a Democrat with a little D, in that she's sort of in opposition to the gatekeepers, people like the jury chairman who are trying to decide what gets out and what doesn't get out, and she's coming along and saying, you don't get to decide that. Information's information, and I want to put it out there.
Because that is the new debate, really, in journalism, is what information's allowed to get out or not.
Right.
And that seemed quite an undercurrent in the book as well. Like, who knows what and who's allowed to know what as well.
I worked at the New York Times, which on some level is the ultimate gatekeeper, and yet
in a way, I was always uncomfortable with that role. In the end, despite all the problems with the current sort of anarchic system, I prefer it because I don't think there should be a tiny group of people deciding what is worth reporting, what is not worth reporting, what's important, what's not important. You know, the more out there, the better, and let people decide for themselves.
Mm. And you were in New York when 9/11 happened. So how soon after that did you begin to think of this, of making a novel out of the extraordinary way that New York was in the decade after?
It's funny, I never thought about it after reporting on 9/11. And then it was about 2 years later, and the memorial competition was going on. I was talking to a friend who was an artist and asking if she was going to enter, and we were talking about the politics of it and started talking about Maya Lin, who won the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Competition. And in thinking about that, you know, that part of the resistance to her was her being Asian American. I just thought, oh, you know, it would be like if an American Muslim won, and instantly thought, oh, that's a novel.
And was there any character who really stayed with you afterwards, so you can still hear slightly after?
You know, when I was writing, I felt very, whichever character I was working on, I felt just incredibly drawn into their perspective, and it almost blocked out everybody else in the novel. It's Mo that people want to talk about. I was at an event this weekend at a book fair, and a woman said, "Did you ever just want to shake Muhammad and tell him to explain himself a little bit?" I get a lot of things like, you know, people really, in a way that's satisfying to me, just grapple with his character and his rigidity and being so difficult on some level, and sort of the way that reps against sort of their principle that, of course, he has the right to do that. And so I like seeing, I almost feel like they're tangled in a knot around him.
And how hard was it as a journalist to switch to a novelist in the sense that you have to show instead of tell?
When I started, I found it in some way just really fun, not having to chase down every fact and just the freedom of kind of playing on the page. But I think that took a while to learn. I mean, my first draft was close to 800 pages, and I think it was because I was spelling things out much more, and it just took learning that I don't need to always explain why people are doing what they're doing, and that, in fact, part of a novel to me is the mystery of it, and that a reader sort of completes that for themselves and is trying to figure it out. And, you know, I learned how to do in a paragraph what at first took me 4 pages in terms of explaining somebody's thinking. And so, and there were just a lot of scenes I wrote and threw out. I mean, my publisher always says you learn to write a novel by writing a novel, and that was very true in my case. I mean, there was so much that I wrote and discarded, but I had to.
Now if they ask me, I could write a book about the way you walk and whisper and look.
And that's all 5 of the authors shortlisted for the Guardian First Book Award. We'll be able to tell you who the winner is next week in a podcast that maintains our topical focus with a look at novels and non-fiction books about finance and the economy. In this week's Guardian Review, The Great and the Good, from Jonathan Franzen and Robert Harris to Hilary Mantel and Julian Barnes, recommend their books of the year. Ian Jack reviews Masters of the Post, The Rise and Fall of Royal Mail, and we interview John Grisham. In the Observer New Review on Sunday, authors and celebrities select the books they'd like to give and receive this Christmas. Peter Conrad reviews The Prague Cemetery by Umberto Eco, and there's a Q&A with the author of New York zombie novel Zone 1, Colson Whitehead. And on guardian.co.uk/books, as well as all the usual news and blogs, Daniel Calder waxes lyrical about Philip K. Dick's private mystical text, The Exegesis. Niall Rogers gives us his top 10 music books, and we take a peek at what's on Tom McCarthy's desktop. So goodbye from me, Sarah Crown, and my producer, Tim Maybe.
Then the world discovers that as my book ends, how to make two lovers a friend.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.